battling here with China is a very serious threat to our economy and our national security.
China and the U.S. square off over economics and much more. It's Friday, December 7th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, new calls to investigate mistreatment of Rohingya, the battle over 5G technology, and saying a final goodbye, all without saying a thing. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. and international markets were in a tumble Thursday, spurred by a set of unwelcome news stories. Well, at least for stock traders. First was the arrest of Mengwan Zhu, a key executive with Chinese telecom giant Huawei Technologies. Her arrest in Canada could threaten the recent truce in the trade war between the U.S. and China. Chinese authorities have called on Washington and Ottawa to explain why Meng was arrested and have demanded her release. Second, there are broader concerns among some financial analysts that both the U.S. and Chinese economies are slowing. Exactly at the same time, they're both ratcheting up accusations of leading a tariff war between the U.S. and China. Some in Washington and on Wall Street have been urging the Trump administration to take a softer tone on Beijing to help ease tensions. But top White House officials are continuing to take a hard line on U.S.-China trade talks, even after the arrest of Mengwan Zhu. Some fear that could derail the trade truce between the two giant economies. Speaking with VOA reporter Bill Gallo, White House trade and economic advisor Peter Navarro said that the Trump administration is asking, not demanding, that China make fundamental changes to its economy.
Well, the bigger problem the United States faces with China is a massive effort, both legal and illegal, to take the technological crown jewels of America. And this takes place through actions like a forced technology transfer, which is illegal, cyber intrusions into our business, which are facilitated in some ways by companies like Huawei and ZTE and others, but also legally, but dangerously, by Chinese state-directed investment in places like Silicon Valley. So what we're grappling here with China is a very serious threat to our economy and our national security through China's aggression against our technology and our intellectual property. So that's the big picture. And so what we're trying to do here with China, with President Trump leading the way in Argentina at a historic session, it was a dinner, but there wasn't a lot of food eaten, really. It was more a working session. I mean, what happened there was China, for 45 minutes, Chinese president, laying out all the things that they would agree to do to address our concerns, and by implication, acknowledging that they were engaged in these illegal activities.
Yes. And you've been very optimistic publicly in your comments about the direction of these talks. Are you still confident that the U.S. and China will agree to something within this 90-day period? Has nothing changed for you? Are you still very publicly optimistic?
The extraordinary event of that dinner, which I don't believe has ever happened before in history, is the Chinese president himself spending 45 minutes presenting a deal to the American president. It's very unusual and unprecedented, I believe. Usually what happens with these things is that there's a deal worked out beforehand and minions, the Chinese bureaucracy, somebody would present it. But to have the president himself offer just a long list of things makes it clear that China is signaling that this is a high priority for them.
Do you trust that Xi Jinping will do what he says? I mean, do you have a reliable negotiating partner here?
You're anticipating my butt.
Okay.
Which is, we're clear-eyed about this, and we understand the long history of China's failure to honor its commitments, a very long history. If you go back simply to the China joining the World Trade Organization in 2001, China made a mockery of those rules. And if you fast forward to 2015, the two key promises that China made to the American president at the time was not to militarize the South China Sea and to stop its cyber intrusions into American business networks. And both of those promises have been shattered.
Trump and President Trump and yourself have also said that if it doesn't work out in 90 days, you will increase tariffs. Do you get a sense that U.S. businesses and Wall Street are prepared for a standoff with China over some of these fundamental issues you're talking about, right? And I mean, we're seeing some volatility in the markets now, but presumably if things did not work out in 90 days and you were committed to seeing this through, fundamental changes in the Chinese economy, is the U.S. and is Wall Street prepared to deal with that?
Well, first of all, my own view of the markets is that a lot of the volatility is driven by interest rate policies, which have been disruptive to investment and particularly to the housing sector. And we're still kind of working our way through that. If you look just broad brush, the tariffs that have been imposed and the additional tariffs that might be imposed affect a very small part of the American economy and the flow of trade. So they're not market-moving events per se. So I think that one of the problems we face politically is that the Wall Street wing of America that basically wants to maintain a status quo of shipping our jobs offshore to China wants to create a bit of uncertainty and hysteria to pressure this administration to back down from what is a necessary response to China's aggression against our technology and innovation base.
China, of course, is currently detaining up to 1 million Uyghurs in a system of secret prisons. It's, of course, rolling out an Orwellian system of social credit. It jails dissidents, doesn't allow freedom of speech. You mentioned some of these issues in your book, Death by China. You have been quite outspoken on this. Is the Trump administration willing, you think, to use human rights in this trade discussion as sort of a pressure point?
That one, again, is outside my lane. I would simply refer you to one of the most important speeches that's been given during this administration, which is that of Vice President Mike Pence at the Hudson Institute, where he not only went through the wide range of aggressive economic practices China engages in, but also mentioned the persecution of people in China. So it's clearly on the radar screen of this administration. These practices are abhorrent, but it's not my place to discuss how they might affect any negotiation on trade.
White House Senior Advisor Peter Navarro speaking with VOA's Bill Gallo. These are the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Philippine immigration authorities say they have arrested an American Roman Catholic priest accused of sexually assaulting altar boys. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the military alliance remains committed to restoring peace in Afghanistan. An Australian court overturned the conviction of a former archbishop who had been the world's most senior Catholic cleric, held guilty of concealing child sex abuse. And Bangladeshi opposition leader Khaleda Zia is ineligible to contest the December 30 elections because she has been sentenced to 2 prison terms in corruption cases. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. A Washington-based global pro bono legal organization has called for creation of a criminal tribunal for those responsible for atrocities committed against the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, also known as Burma, and bring them to justice. Hundreds of thousands of the minority Muslim group fled western Myanmar more than a year ago to escape a security crackdown that the UN has likened to ethnic cleansing. The Public International Law and Policy Group interviewed over 1,000 Rohingya refugees in camps in Bangladesh to determine whether crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide took place. Daniel Fullerton, a counselor and program manager, told VOA's Victor Beatty that the firm completed a thorough legal analysis of their findings.
And after we assembled a team of international legal experts, we spent several months going through more than 15,000 pages of documentation that we collected in that investigation. And ultimately, we did determine that there are reasonable grounds to believe that crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes were committed against the Rohingya. And so specifically, the fact that we use that reasonable grounds to believe standard, which is the same one that the ICC uses, for instance, to determine whether to move forward with opening an investigation, really also lent us to the fact that really accountability needs to be the next step. So we don't necessarily prescribe precisely what that accountability should look like. Really, we consider the international community's duty to ensure accountability to primarily be one of result, and the ultimate purpose of that duty being to provide justice to victims, deter potential perpetrators, and prevent future mass atrocities.
Of course, we've heard many accounts from the UN and other authorities about what has been called ethnic cleansing as security forces cracked down on the Rohingya Muslims more than a year ago. What do you hope to gain with this new report? Is it to prod a certain direction for U.S. policy?
So we don't really seek to influence policy in one direction or another. We stay really in our strict legal sandbox. But one of the things that we saw the value in moving forward this report and our findings on these crimes was to, on one hand, provide a bit more legal clarity to the discussion around the Rohingya, because crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide are more legally distinct in international law than labels such as ethnic cleansing. And additionally, we also felt it was part of the duty we owed to all of those refugees that we interviewed to make sure that their stories were told and shared in full. And part of that telling it in full is also what the legal ramifications of what they were saying have for the crimes that are committed against them.
According to this report, you're calling for the urgent establishment of an accountability mechanism or referral to the International Criminal Court. So the UN, of course, is well aware of this situation, but the Myanmar government has really not been cooperative in pursuing a lot of prosecution. So what direction do we go next?
I think the next step is really going to be a lot focused around the independent investigation mechanism that the United Nations is working on standing up following the creation of that mandate out of the Human Rights Commission earlier this year, which will hopefully be able to bring together the evidence that a lot of other groups have been collecting into the crimes against the Rohingya, conduct its own investigation as well. I mean, ideally, to get the full realm of what has happened, it would require investigators getting on the ground inside of Rakhine State, which I know has been and likely will continue to remain a challenge for most investigators without increased cooperation from the Myanmar government. But we also do see some interesting movement from the ICC itself, with the pretrial chamber establishing some jurisdiction over some limited crimes related to the crimes against refugees that were displaced into Bangladesh, and using that as a means of creating some jurisdiction as well.
In August, the United Nations concluded Myanmar's security forces carried out mass killings, scorching villages, and gang rapes of Rohingya Muslims with genocidal intent. Happening now in Asia, Asian regional markets fell 1.8% on average, heading for its biggest daily plunge in 6 weeks, as markets from Tokyo to Hong Kong and Mumbai sank. The rally seen last week has more than vanished, with Asian equity values taking their losses from a January high to $6.2 trillion. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. And we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Many experts predict that the emerging 5G, or fifth generation, wireless technology will revolutionize the world's entire industrial economy. They say it holds the key to a smarter, more efficient, more connected, and much wealthier world. But a recent congressional report outlines how China plans to use the transition to 5G and its access to billions of networked electronic devices for intelligence gathering, sabotage, and business deals. As VOA's Gela De Franceschi reports, China's aim is to put an end to American high-tech preeminence.
The coming 5G networks will bring billions of new devices online, changing the way we work and live. It brings lightning speed to support advanced technologies and promises millions of new jobs. China intends to win the 5G race. The Made in China 2025 plan presented at the 19th Party Congress last year clearly states the end goal is not just to achieve technology leadership, but to eventually govern it.
We also have a very serious competitor who is pressing ahead in this direction in ways that the U.S. is bound to respond to. The issue of 5G technology plays into the larger picture of the U.S.'s national security, American economic security, and also to our stance of alliances around the world.
To date, at least 61 countries have an agreement or have announced testing of gear made by Chinese IT giant Huawei. 10 of them, including Britain, Portugal, Italy, Mexico, and the Philippines, have announced deals to start using it in their 5G networks. The growing number of countries opting for Huawei is tied to China's comprehensive bargain deals, say industry leaders.
The Chinese government, to make a long story short, is prepared to subsidize the cost of equipment to an unprecedented degree.
It's a multi-sectoral, cross-sectoral approach with energy companies and the web-scale companies. And the push is, look at all of the economies of scale, look at all the advantages, look at the cheap equipment that we can provide. And then there's also diplomatic pressure. There's investment in the civil infrastructure of countries that are struggling financially.
China's advance is raising Washington's concerns about the use of Huawei equipment in countries that host U.S. military bases such as Germany, Italy, and Japan. Huawei is known to have ties to China's military and intelligence agencies.
Our armed services, who will look forward to being able to use 5G networks in Asia, in Europe, in the Middle East, to know that they'll be sharing that information across those 5G networks that are wired by Chinese companies, specifically by Huawei, is not going to make them feel very comfortable.
But veteran policy advisor Karl Rove says China is not infallible.
They got a reputation for shoddy equipment and shoddy deployment. The debt dependency instances in Africa and Asia are causing some people to have doubts about whether or not they want to be further dependent upon the Chinese. The third thing is the Chinese, even for a thing like this, don't have enough money.
The U.S. and Chinese leaders discussed the issue on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Gela De Franceschi, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Online travel index and directory Travel Index launched a restaurant ranking for 5 cities in Asia: Bangkok, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Delhi. However, with the exception of Delhi, all the chart toppers are restaurants that serve European cuisine. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia: women, especially in China, are playing an increasingly large role in Asia's luxury spending. That's a key finding of Wealth Report Asia 2018, Bank Julius Baer's latest look into high-end consumption in the region. All the big stories coming your way throughout the day. This is VOA Asia. This This has been a solemn, at times exhausting week in the United States. The nation collectively paused to bid farewell to the 41st President of the United States, George H.W. Bush. It was a week of ceremony rarely seen in America. Lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda, a full state funeral at the National Cathedral, complete with every president, former and current, in attendance, a final trip on Air Force One, and on Thursday, a smaller ceremony in Houston before his final interment next to his wife Barbara and their daughter Robin, who died at the age of 3. At this point, nearly everything that can be said about Poppy Bush, as he was known by his family, has been said, except for one final non-verbal send-off, the sounding of taps. At 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, hundreds of volunteer buglers stationed around the country will play taps to coincide with the events in College Station, Texas. One of them is Rick Barnes, a major in the Maryland Defense Force and also a colleague of ours here at VOA.
5:30 Eastern Time today is 4:30 Central Time, which should be the end of the internment ceremony for President George H.W. Bush. In honor of his service and his work, in excess of 250 buglers nationwide will be sounding taps at various locations. A good friend of mine will be sounding taps at the birthplace of our national anthem at Fort McHenry in Baltimore. I just read on Facebook shortly before coming down to your studio that another colleague will be playing taps, rather sounding taps. We sound bugle calls. We don't play them. He will be sounding taps at the Navy Memorial here in Washington, D.C.
And, of course, you'll be basically in front of the U.S. Capitol.
Yes, exactly.
Has anything like this been done before? I've not heard of something like this.
We have done two mass buglers events. The first was for the 150th anniversary of the composition of taps by General Butterfield during the Civil War. We gathered together at Arlington National Cemetery at the Garden of Stone. We had a ceremony there, and then at the end, we had a four-part harmonization of taps conducted by the commander of the Marine Band. And then we dispersed throughout the graveyard, throughout the cemetery, waited for the 12th chime of noon, and then sounded taps. And I will tell you, it was an amazing experience to hear it bouncing all over the place.
I imagine many, many, many people have heard taps. It's just a literally an iconic piece of music or composition. But as a lifelong military man, I mean, what does taps mean for you and members of the military?
Taps is the final honor that is rendered to a fallen veteran. Every veteran is afforded the opportunity to have a military ceremony when they pass away. There are three elements to that. The final, last honor that is given to a veteran is the sounding of taps. And it brings their service to our nation to a close. And so I've done this many, many times while I was on active duty in the Army as an enlisted bandsman. I've done it many, many times as a musician with the Maryland Defense Force as well.
Does it ever get emotional?
It always gets emotional. Taps is the moment when the next of kin realizes, you know, that this is it. This is it. And that gets very emotional.
And so to close this week, a final wordless send-off for President Bush, Rick Barnes sounds taps. That's all from us for today. See you next week.